From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the world reacts to Paris terror, the new Congress takes on the president, travel to Cuba opens up, and an alleged terror plot against the U.S. Capitol. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula took credit for last week's attacks, what they called the Blessed Battle of Paris, in a video featuring top commander Nasser al-Ansi. Republican Representative Jeb Hensarling of Texas said the president has gone too far with his executive actions on immigration.
His executive action on immigration is an unconstitutional power grab. It tramples on the authority that the Constitution gives Congress.
And a young Ohio man is arrested by the FBI for an alleged ISIS-inspired terror plot on the Capitol building in Washington.
The FBI says 20-year-old Christopher Lee Cornell of Green Township, Ohio, wanted to set off pipe bombs at the U.S. Capitol and shoot people as they fled.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Michael Hirsch of Politico, Rachel Smolkin of CNN Politics, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's your top story this week? What are you thinking on terror, Congress, Mitt Romney? Are you on your way to Cuba? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from Washington is Michael Hirsch, national editor for Politico magazine, former foreign editor and chief diplomatic correspondent for Newsweek. Michael Hirsch, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And from Washington, Rachel Smolkin joins us, executive editor at CNN Politics. Rachel, great to have you here.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Michael, and Rachel.
All kinds of disturbing sounds coming out of Europe and beyond this week. The big unity rally on Sunday, we weren't there in enough strength of the Obama administration, but more than a million people marched. At one point, someone started to play Imagine by John Lennon. The crowd began to sing along and cheer. There's the unity part, and many French people in the streets on that day said, we don't want to be torn apart by terrorism, we want to be as one. But there were other reactions as well. The BBC yesterday, far-right French politician Marie Le Pen said her country had been lax in confronting Islamic fundamentalism. Here she's interpreted by the BBC.
We have to have courage to face reality. Terrorism is only a means of Islamic fundamentalism. Behind terrorism is an ideology which developed in our land, in our cities. We haven't wanted to face up to it because of political correctness and fear.
Michael Hirsch, the day of Charlie Hebdo and the kosher supermarket were hardly the end of this. Lots of arrests now around Europe. This big shooting match, I guess, in Belgium. What do we see unfolding in the aftermath of Charlie Hebdo?
Well, politically, President Obama, you know, has been hammered for not taking part in the big protest march or sending someone like Joe Biden. You see this remarkable display of unity, but laced with forbidding signs of future division, you know, in the person of people like Marine Le Pen and the far right, which is obviously exploiting this take on the Muslim problem. You have a huge Muslim underclass in Europe, and there is an argument that the Europeans are going about this the wrong way by lionizing Charlie Hebdo and its depiction of the Prophet Muhammad. Clearly, the exercise of free speech is being defended and should be, and these acts were horrific, you know, against the cartoonists and journalists who were part of Charlie Hebdo. But is that really the symbol of free speech we want to hold up, and do you really want to alienate so many of Europe's Muslims in this way? There's also the question of whether maybe a little bit too much is being made of this. I mean, after all, these were the horrific acts of three gunmen, one of whom spent much of his day occupying the kosher market that he took over, watching the media accounts of what he had done. I mean, clearly these are people who are looking to get the kind of attention they're getting now. And I think there's some questions about whether perhaps Europe has made a little bit too much of this.
Rachel, maybe too much. On the other hand, now you've got Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula saying this was our operation, Charlie Hebdo, and a lot of security analysts saying this is the new way. Less central command and control, therefore harder to track down, harder to surveil.
and lots of people traveling to Syria, to the Middle East, and then coming back to Europe with a lot of familiarity with some pretty devastating tactics for wreaking havoc, Rachel.
That's right. And I think that's the key takeaway for me from this week. It's important to note those ties to those ties are still being examined. We don't have the full picture yet. But certainly the question of citizens from Europe, from other nations going over, doing some training, becoming radicalized and coming back, kind of fading into the fabric of their former societies, or at least that's how it appears until something like this happens. And we saw not just the tragedies in Paris, but, you know, other signs around the world. This story is continuing to spread. There were some scares in the United States this week, and it does show how the world is changing around us. There have long been concerns about lone wolf attacks, but these are of a different nature.
And Europe wondering how to stay on top of this. I'm reading here, Jack, today, the chief of Europol, that's the European Union police agency, saying that the large number of radicalized Muslim extremists across Europe and their lack of command structure, meaning you can't track orders coming in, make it extremely difficult, he's saying, for law enforcement agencies to foil every attack. Just too many potential actors here, Jack.
Too many, and you know, the two brothers. How do you break that circle? Who were involved mm-hmm. in the Charlie Hebdo attack? That's as close as as closely held a secret as if it were one person. You know, I want to join with what Michael said. His magazine this morning runs a very interesting article by a British journalist, Ami Khan, quoting from a jihadi document called "Management of Savagery." And they say the goal is to transform societies into two opposing groups, igniting a violent battle between them, whose end is either victory or martyrdom. Well, the Charlie Hebdo attack has exactly succeeded there. The Times quoted a young man in one of these wretched suburbs of Paris, young Muslim man, saying, "You can't say Charlie, I'm Charlie around here." Meanwhile, Jean-Marie Le Pen, Marine Le Pen's father, said, "I am Charlie Martel, the Frankish leader who expelled the Muslim invasion of Europe in the 8th century." There's the polarization right there. And meanwhile, you have a French president, very weak, seeing this, it seems to me, partly as an opportunity to boost himself in the polls, which he's done by, you know, making this such a huge, and saying we have now declared war against radical Islam. Mm-hmm. It's almost as if it's a fatality. It's exactly what the jihadis want in this call for, in this strategy booklet, and the French are following it to the letter.
Europeans really wrestling with those, though, trying to send a bunch of different messages here. I mean, here's German Chancellor Angela Merkel. She was talking with the Bundestag in Germany on Thursday and quoting the former German President Christian Wolff, saying Islam is a part of Germany, interpreted here by Deutsche Welle.
Christianity is without any doubt a part of Germany. Judaism is also without doubt a part of Germany. That's our Judeo-Christian history. But Islam has now also become part of Germany, end of quote.
There's the German chancellor saying Islam, quoting a former president, saying Islam's part of Germany. We want this to all work together. On the other hand, you had Jews in France very worried about what's going on there. And you had Netanyahu, the leader of Israel, among many other foreign leaders in attendance at that unity rally. At the Grand Synagogue in Paris on Sunday, the Israeli prime minister said France's Jews were always welcome to bail, come to Israel. Interesting response. Here he says, Netanyahu, any Jew who wishes to immigrate to Israel will be welcomed with open arms and warm and accepting hearts. I mean, there was applause, but when he finished, Michael Hirsch, you may have heard this, the crowd spontaneously broke into singing the Marseillaise, the French national anthem, to express pride in their country. I mean, many have gone to Israel, but conflicting sentiments here, Michael.
Oh, well, very much so. I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu, as always, is following his own agenda. It was hardly surprising that François Hollande, the French president, didn't really want him there because his presence might be divisive. Of course, Israel's agenda is to get more Israelis because they have a demographic issue in their own region, which is, you know, quite apart from the whole issue we're dealing with now with jihadism in Europe. It would not be surprising if really only a relatively few French decided to emigrate in the wake of this. Clearly, that is being debated now in the French Jewish community. But I think for many of them, they are, you know, very much as much Frenchmen, French women, as they are Jewish. So I don't expect to see a huge trend out of Europe just as a result of this single act.
Look, you can point anywhere for your indicators here, but I'm looking at an AP story right now out of Turkey. 160 people there have held funeral prayers today to honor the two brothers who killed 12 in Paris last week, shouting God is great, holding up a banner showing Osama bin Laden's picture on one side and pictures of Sharif and Saeed Kouachi on the other, superimposed over the Parisian skyline with little posters saying, we're all Sharif, we're all Saeed. Rachel Smolkin, to pull the dark energy out of this meeting of minds and perspectives is not easy.
Well, I you know, your phrase dark energy is so powerful and so correct. I mean, that's exactly what we're seeing come out of this, but also we are seeing more of a discussion around it, and I think that's important as well.
I mean, a discussion, more than a discussion in Washington this week, right? They said we had a plot on the U.S. Capitol building. Did that look sound? Did it look like the FBI was delivering a real deal story there, Rachel?
Well, we've seen a number of questions about, about FBI involvement, and this is just the latest. But
involvement meaning undercover tracking involvement or law enforcement?
Of law enforcement being involved, and this was a man who, I'm fighting off a cold.
You fight the cold. We'll take a short break here, Rachel. We're at Rachel Smolkin with CNN Standby in Washington. Michael Hirsch with Politico Magazine. Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're looking at a week in the news. Arrests beyond the Paris attacks. Congress and the president go at it. Mitt Romney may be back. An alleged terror plot in D.C. Boko Haram raids on in Nigeria and beyond. Michael Hirsch is with us, national editor for Politico magazine. Rachel Smolkin, executive editor of CNN Politics, is here. Jack Beatty's here. You can join us as well. FBI agents arrested a 20-year-old Cincinnati man on Wednesday for an alleged plot, terror plot against the Capitol. On Sunday, even before that, Attorney General Eric Holder had told CBS, Face the Nation, deeply concerned about just this kind of attack in the United States.
It's something that frankly keeps me up at night, worrying about the lone wolf or a group of people, a very small group of people who decide to get arms on their own and do what we saw in France.
Rachel, Michael, Jack, let's go to our listeners. Adam in Worcester, Ohio. Adam, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. So a bit of a question and a bit of a comment in regards to President Obama's choice to not stand in solidarity with the European leaders at the march in honor of the victims of the Charlie Hebdo and the other attack at the grocer. Do you think that I understand that John Kerry has gone and he's apologized sincerely for the U.S. not being at the march, but is it possible that the choice to not have President Obama standing with the other European leaders in solidarity was to not have a photograph out there of him with them as a possibility of a tactic to not give terrorist leaders more propaganda with such a photo? And if that there are many circumstances as to why he would have not gone, but where the choices of the President Obama to not be present at things and how it could affect propaganda for terrorist leaders. Thank you.
And maybe security here. Adam, thanks for your call. Michael, how about it? The U.S. ducking that so as not to wave a red flag in front of AQAP or ISIL or ISIS? Or what do you make of Adam's skepticism or question, Michael?
I think he's right on point. I don't know how much of a factor that is, but let's look at the very different way the U.S. has approached these lone wolf acts of terrorism. The Boston Marathon bombers were treated as criminals or being tried as such. The French and other Europeans have sort of declared themselves anew in a war, and that does play into al-Qaeda's propaganda, as Jack was suggesting earlier. I think that even though it seems the White House was taken by surprise to some degree by the extent of this march, and Obama was not likely to go, and I'm sure Secret Service considerations played into that, I think there was also a strategic move not to, again, you know, overstate the case, not to make too much of these lone wolf attacks, because that's exactly what they are. These are criminals who commit terrible acts, who are, in fact, in terms of their mindset, if you set aside the Islamists, are probably not very different from mass murderers in this country, like, you know, the ones who shoot up movie theaters and such. And let's not turn this into a civilizational war. And I think that's the danger right now of this, you know, huge show of strategic unity on the part of all these European leaders. And I think Obama wanted to stay away from that.
But are they criminals in lone acts if they've been to Yemen and beyond, if they've got money and guidance from Anwar al-Awlaki, if al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is taking credit for this and saying we want more of this and encourage, and the Islamic State encouraging more of this? I mean, are you sure you've got the right conceptual understanding from the, I guess, aggressor side, maybe the right?
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly not, you know, a typical criminal act, and there are indications we've had that Anwar al-Awlaki, the, you know, since terminated a U.S.-born leader, al-Qaeda leader in Yemen, had promoted and even funded the Sharif brothers, at least early on. And that they did get some training from ISIS. But that doesn't mean that what they did, which was, you know, going in the middle of Paris into a newspaper office and shooting people dead, was not just mainly a criminal act and should be treated as such, as opposed to being part of a broad-based global war, which, again, is precisely the way al-Qaeda sees it in its propaganda. Do we really want to play into that propaganda in this way?
It may be that no matter how you interpret it strategically, not going that way might be the way to go, not play into those hands. We did have the White House spokesman Josh Earnest saying the administration had erred in not sending a higher official to the huge Sunday rally in Paris.
To the extent that there are those who are out there saying that the administration should have sent someone with a higher profile to participate in the march, I guess what I'm saying is that we agree that we should have sent someone with a higher profile, again, in addition to the ambassador to France.
Whoops, too bad. John Kerry is there now, says he's there to share a big hug with Paris. Laura in Dennis, Massachusetts. Laura, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just wonder why we don't have more travel restrictions to these countries where these people are being trained. And, you know, they talked about a ban on travel to the countries that had Ebola, but I think this is a lot more important. And also, you know, it didn't make sense to ban travel there because they needed help over there. But I think it does make sense to ban travel to these countries, or to put people through so much that they really, you know, that we know who they are and we can really watch them when they come back.
Yeah, Laura, I appreciate your call. Jack, it is interesting how many have gone from Europe and many now returned. And of course, if you see the kind of mayhem that has been unleashed in Syria and how relatively easy it is to unravel things once that gets started, I guess feel much more empowered to do that even in a more settled society like Europe. But Jack, Europe has more restrictions on passports and holding them and everything else than the U.S. does, and still we've got this big back and forth. It is interesting that that's been permitted to go on.
It is, and yes, they have restrictions, but what I was struck with in some of the European commentary was how relatively, at least judged by the standards of the past, it was for Europeans to travel one place to another and to Turkey. And, you know, in all of this, the role of Turkey, which is the sort of entrepot for most of the people going to ISIS, that sort of double game they have been playing, at least in the past, there needs to be some kind of reckoning there. Because if anybody can stop this, it can be stopped. Well, I don't know if it can be, but surely the government. You know, energetic effort to police their borders, and they have not done that. And although they seem to be able to track people right to the border, and then the people disappear. Well, if they can track them to the border, can't they prevent them going across the border?
I don't know. Reach out and touch the Turkish border down there. I'm not sure. All kinds of tightening going on right now in Europe. That's for sure, including plenty being arrested for speaking out in support of the terror attacks. Pope Francis got into this from way off on his way to the Philippines, saying there are limits to free speech. And he was using Vatican aide Alberto Gaspari as a prop to make his point. Here he is on the plane, interpreted by the BBC.
È vero che non si può reagire violentamente. I believe you cannot react violently, but if my good friend Dr. Gaspari says a curse word against my mother, he can expect a punch. It's normal. You cannot provoke. You cannot insult the faith of others. You cannot make fun of the faith of others.
You cannot make fun of the faith of others. Don't be violent, but expect a punch. I'm not sure what the difference is. Sean in Seneca Falls, New York. Sean, you're on the air.
Yeah, exactly what that was just expressed, is a disgrace. Seriously. If your faith cannot withstand your beard being pulled in whatever amount, in whatever context, then you are wrong. If you can't handle me saying, if there is a God, may he strike me down right on air, and you have to come and do something to me, or if I'm making fun of your little holy book and you can't handle it, you're doing something wrong.
So you think the Pope is off base, that there's no special consideration?
It darn well better be able to be made fun of. Otherwise, you're in the wrong. Do we have to adjust to these people and their little holy book? No, they have to adjust to us. They have to adjust to the rest of the world. Patton Oswalt was right. We don't have to sit there and respect their thing. We have to acknowledge their thing. We don't have to respect it.
Sean, I hear you loud and clear, but the world is kind of little, too. I don't know about anybody's holy book and its size, but the world is kind of small here. And yet, my sympathies are right with that call for freedom of speech that you articulate there. Let me get one more, if I may. Georgetown. Dan is calling. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
Yeah, my point is, as human beings, I think we need to be skeptical about what is happening. There seemed to be a giant shift, and it was after 9/11, of course, and we're basically powerless to the news that comes to us, and the news is slanted a certain way, and we consume it. And it seems like we've turned into more like a mob mentality when we're putting these things together. And in doing that, we're not living up to our human obligation of questioning things and having science and facts up against political swings.
Dan, I'm all for that. Some things are kind of hard to analyze scientifically when you get into issues of free speech and meetings of culture and what's criminal, but point taken. Rachel Smolkin, what did you hear in the Pope's assertion there? Is he justifying in some way, though he says no violence, the attacks on Charlie Hebdo?
I do not think the intent was to justify, but to reflect the very real debate about the images and where does free speech end? Are there limits on free speech? And even if there are not limits, are there moments that you should choose not to head in that direction? We really saw this play out this week, and not just in the comments we've just been discussing, but media organizations throughout the week, and including my own and many others, were wrestling with this question. Do you publish the photo, the sketches, the cartoons by Charlie Hebdo, or do you not? Do you put the new cover out there, or do you not? Where does free speech begin and end? Does it have no end? But there are questions of taste. There are questions of what's offensive to many, many people around the world. Do you balance those things? There are security considerations as well for news organizations with staff around the world and staff who put themselves at great risk every day to bring the stories they're covering to their audience. So all of those things go into the mix together. We saw news organizations handling that question very differently.
Big issues here. Freedom, and also how far down this road of conflict do we go? Got to bring it back home. News in the United States as well, and in Congress. Rachel, your neck of the woods in particular on presidential authority, on immigration, on Wall Street regulation. The House of Representatives voted on Wednesday to block funding to President Obama's executive actions on immigration that would have let millions more stay in the country without fear of deportation. Speaking on the floor of the House before the vote, here's Speaker John Boehner explaining the move.
We do not take this action lightly, but simply, there is no alternative. This is not a dispute between the parties or even between the branches of our government. This executive overreach is an affront to the rule of law and to the Constitution itself.
Rachel, there's no policy differential here, just a difference of opinion on the Constitution. Is that true?
Well, of course it's not true. It's a, you know, there are differences of opinions on many, many things. You know, the interesting thing to me about what we saw this week in Congress is just how quickly we saw the narratives of the year getting started. We saw it starting with House Speaker John Boehner's reelection, where there was a bigger protest vote than expected against him. He of course, did manage to be reelected. We've seen the House already pushing back on immigration. So we're seeing very quickly Congress take on the president. Of course, we all know that the president's narrative for the last many months has been that he's going to get things done on his own without Congress. He's going to go around Congress and use his executive actions. We see the new energized Republican Congress coming in and saying, wait a minute, no, you're not. We're going to do everything in our power to stop that. You're seeing the fights between moderates and conservatives play out within the House. You're seeing the friction over immigration between the House and the Senate already. So all of these things that we're going to be watching so carefully throughout the year, they were all very quickly jump-started in January.
The president's plan, his executive orders, would give a kind of safe harbor to, what, 4 million or more illegal immigrants who have citizen children. Is that on track to be turned around by Congress, or is it a talking point but no change, Rachel?
Well, it's got to get through the Senate, and there's controversy. You know, Senator Lindsey Graham said this week his colleagues are playing with fire, connecting a political assault on the president to funding for Homeland Security. So this is a tough fight we're seeing in Congress, and we'll continue to see this.
Michael, what do you see in the immigration debate in particular here and the way it's now been lashed to Homeland Security funding? And I assume Lindsey Graham, thinking of fire, is also thinking about the immigrant vote.
Right. Well, this is going to switch pretty quickly from being a problem for Obama because it doesn't get through the Senate, you know, in terms of this particular piece of legislation, to being perhaps the single biggest headache for the Republican Party as we head into the 2016 campaign season. We saw that at their recent retreat in Hershey, Pennsylvania. One of the newspaper headlines was "A sweet retreat turned sour," referring to the chocolate factory there. But the fact was that the Republicans simply cannot agree on a way of dealing with this issue of immigration reform in general, much less the specifics of Obama's executive order. And you have clearly among the national party strategists a perception that they do need to compromise on reform. They can't alienate the Hispanic vote the way Mitt Romney did in 2012. And yet in the base of the party, you see firm resistance, particularly in the South and the West. In the Midwest is a very different approach. It's a much more moderate approach to immigrants. So you have a party that is badly divided, and I think is going to continue to be going into the presidential election year on this issue.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, two free climbers made history reaching the summit of El Capitan, the towering 3,000-foot rock face in Yosemite National Park on Wednesday. Here's climber Kevin Jorgensen.
Honestly, the thing that hurts the most right now are our legs from hiking down because we haven't used them in 19 days. And aside from the skin on my hands, body feels fine.
19 days. That's a lot of climbing. Pretty amazing. Oscar nominations announced yesterday. Not a single one of the 20 acting nominations went to a non-white actor. For the first time in almost two decades, here's Jimmy Fallon last night.
They're so white. Matthew McConaughey, take a look at all the nominees. He said, all white, all white, all white. I mean, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, okay. And Tina Fey and Amy Poehler hosted the Golden Globes, making headlines for their taking their humor aggressively to the allegations of pills and rape surrounding Bill Cosby.
Cosby admitted to a reporter, "I put the pills in the people. The people did not want the pills in them."
No, Tina, that's not right. That's not right. It's more like, "I got the pills in the bathroom, but I put them in the people."
Playing hardball there, hosting the Golden Globes. We're looking at a week in the news. Arrests beyond the Paris attacks. Congress and the president go at it. Mitt Romney may be back. An alleged terror plot in D.C. Michael Hirsch is here from Politico. Rachel Smolkin from CNN Politics. Big tussle over Wall Street regulation. Dodd-Frank legislation this week as well. Efforts to trim it, to cut it back. Democratic Representative Maxine Waters of California spoke in opposition to a bill that would ease those banking regulations and to the way Republicans were trying to pass legislation.
They hope they can jam these bills through Congress by attaching them to must-pass legislation. And most of all, they hope these issues are way too complicated or too technical for the American people to understand or care about. But the American people really do understand. They remember how our economy was nearly brought to its knees in 2008. And they recognize that we can't let Wall Street slowly chip away at reforms designed to prevent that kind of large-scale financial crisis from happening again.
Well, maybe not, but on Wednesday, the House easily passed a bill that would ease some banking regulations. Before that vote, Republican Jeb Hensarling of Texas mocked Democrats resisting the changes.
To the ultra-left, to our ultra-liberal friends, Dodd-Frank is no longer policy. It is no longer philosophy. It is an article of religious faith. It is sacred text. It was chiseled in stone. It came down from Mount Sinai. Meanwhile, the community banks and the Main Street businesses that are trying to put America back to work are suffering under the sheer weight, load, volume, complexity, and cost of the regulatory burden that has been imposed by our friends on the left.
Jeb Hensarling away with words there. Michael Hirsch, what do you see going on in this week's action on Dodd-Frank and over time with the push to tighten up Wall Street that had so much energy after the meltdown?
I see a very long campaign, and Maxine Waters' words were, I think, fairly accurate. This is the strategy. Attach small and arcane bills that weaken Dodd-Frank to larger legislation that has to pass. This most recent one would give the banks another 2 years to take off of their books some of these very risky securities of the kind that got us into trouble back in 2007, 2008. So I think that the Wall Street lobby is powerful. It's the most moneyed in Washington. They're not going to stop because many of these regulations are so hard to understand. You're not going to see a wide open debate on it. You know, on the Democratic side, basically Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are really the only ones pushing back against the Jeb Hensarlings. So I think, you know, you're going to see over a period of several years, at least, a weakening of Dodd-Frank that people aren't really going to know about probably until the next crisis erupts.
Rachel, is it enough to put us really in danger again? Is Maxine right about that, the congresswoman, or is Jeb Hensarling right? Hey, it's just a little trimming here and there.
It's more than a little trimming. This is follows a couple of other efforts and is the broadest so far to turn back the Dodd-Frank financial law. It does not overturn it, it's important to note, but would delay a couple of key provisions in it and loosen some regulations. We were talking earlier about pushing back on President Obama, and it's important to note that this happened despite his veto threat. And in fact, in the House, 29 Democrats joined with Republicans on this one.
How do you interpret that? 29 Democrats along with Republicans, what are they looking at?
They're looking at the political landscape. I mean, as Michael said, you know, this has been a major issue for Senator Warren, but she's a lone voice or almost a lone voice on this issue. And there's not the outrage behind the passage and the financial law that there was a few years ago. The landscape has shifted somewhat. The economy has improved somewhat. But Senator Warren, this is an issue near and dear to her heart. We started talking about the 2016 race. Of course, she insists she's not running, but every time an issue like this is in the news, it gives her some fresh momentum.
What is where do we end up with this in the Senate and ultimately here? Does this change? Has it changed? Is it set in stone now that it will change?
Democrats have said they're going to push back in the Senate, but it's, you know, this does have some momentum behind it to make some changes. As you know, we just heard the quote, it's not set in stone, it's not chiseled, and it does seem likely that there will be continued changes to the Dodd-Frank financial law.
Mitt Romney, the word coming out of his camp this week that he will almost certainly run for president again, meeting with a lot of money people, putting a national political network back together, former aides and donors and supporters, kind of head spinning in some way. Just last fall, here he was appearing on Fox News talking with Chris Wallace. Mitt Romney said no way he's considering another presidential run.
Let me tell you, it was a great experience running for president. I loved that. But my time has come. Come and gone. I had that opportunity. I ran. I didn't win. And now it's time for someone else to pick up the baton.
Michael Hirst, what's the rationale that's being put together now that Mitt Romney appears to be changing his tune?
Well, I think the perception of Romney and his people was that there wasn't a really strong candidate emerging. And at the same time, the environment, particularly the international environment, had sort of changed in his favor, vindicating some of the policy positions that he put forward in 2012, for example, the danger from Putin and Russia. But what you've seen really in the weeks since he first really changed his tune on this and sent out these signals that he might run is a huge pushback from the Republican brass on down to the grassroots. And I do think that his bid to kind of float this idea of Romney 3, because this would be the third time he runs for president, is getting beaten down pretty severely. I would actually be kind of surprised at this point if he runs in the end, particularly if Jeb Bush throws his hat in.
Tracy in Charleston, South Carolina. Tracy, you're on the air. What do you think?
Well, I'm glad that he made that comment that he's not going to run again, because the last time he made such a ridiculous comment about the majority of the minority of the American people won't hand out. And I just think that it's a good deal that he's not going to run, because what the United States needs, we don't need business people running the country. We need people who have American values, deep heart, deep-seated American values, and that is for America, not about lining the pockets. So, and have sympathy and empathy for all people in America.
But Tracy, when he said he wasn't going to run, that was last September. More up to date, he's very interested in running again, apparently.
Well, then you know what? He's making a mistake, because a leopard don't change his spots. He can say whatever he, and not just him, Obama, all of them, especially Obama. So I hope he don't run. I hope someone worthy in the Republican Party comes to the forefront and represent the party well, and that's really going to look out for the values of America instead of these people with hidden agendas. And so if he does run, I think it'll be a big mistake.
Tracy, we've got it. I appreciate your call. Jack Beatty, the word out of the Romney camp apparently is that if he does indeed run, one of his big themes would be attacking poverty.
Yes, I was surprised to see that. He wants to talk about enterprise, and there he's trying to match Jeb Bush with his right to rise rhetoric. That might be something to hear. But, you know, to pick up on what our caller said, the exit polls of 2012 gave some good news for Mitt Romney. He was way ahead on shares my values over Obama. Beat Obama 2-1, is a strong leader. Was ahead by 10 points on vision for the future over the president. But on this metric, cares about people like me, he lost by 63 points. I mean, no one in American public life has so insulted more American voters than Mr. Romney. I mean, that 47% moochers tape was a tremendous unforced error. And he said it didn't represent what he really felt. No, perhaps not, but it did represent something he has shown himself adept at, and that is pandering. He was pandering there to a kind of country club sensibility. And I think he saw his opening with Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush is saying, I don't want to pander. Jeb Bush has said, you know, you got to be willing to, quote, lose the primary to win the general without violating our principles. That means he wants to be able to say in the primaries, I'm for Common Core, I'm for immigration reform. Well, Mitt Romney doesn't feel those constraints. He's he's now against Common Core, and he's all against immigration reform, and he's saying, I can consolidate that vote on the right. It's just not going over on the right. Sarah Palin says we need new blood. The Wall Street Journal says, Peggy Noonan this morning. They don't want him, and he may be getting that message. You know, years ago, George Reedy wrote a book about, he was President Johnson's press secretary, wrote a book called The Twilight of the Presidency, and about one of the factors that hurt presidents, and he called it the Xanadu effect, where you're surrounded by your same circle every day, and like the poem in Xanadu, did Kublai Khan a stately pleasure dome decree. I think the Xanadu effect of being in the same circle of people who tell you, Mitt, you're great, Mitt, you can win, Mitt, you should have won, I think that's finally, Mr. Romney has succumbed partially to that.
Rachel, enough resistance within the GOP community now, enough distaste there to turn Mr. Romney around, Governor Romney, or not?
He'll be in a position to do what he wants to do. I mean, certainly, if this past week had been intended as his three-peat presidential rollout, it was a very, very shaky one. He would really have to come on strong in his speech that he's making tonight to turn any of that around. It was not a week for a candidate who was road testing. Is this going to work, or putting out some kind of trial balloon? The answer that came back was a fairly resounding one.
Speaking of leaders and decisions, I'm curious about Cuba. This week, Michael Hirsch, another step toward opening up U.S. relations with Cuba, much freer travel there now. And I wonder about the timing of this. Cuba being open to this, the U.S. pushing for this, does this relate to Fidel Castro's health? Is his brother Raul trying to get this done before Fidel's gone so it can appear to have the sanction of the El Supremo?
Well, that could well be. Of course, Fidel Castro's imminent death has been, rumored for, yeah, I think, about 30 years, yeah, now. I do think that this is part of this very extraordinary push by Obama, which was really, the beginning of the president's comeback, if you will, after the midterm defeats. This very sudden and surprising announcement that was also a message to places like Moscow, for example. Look, we're making friends with your old Cold War ally. And on the whole, with the exception of hardliners in the Cuban American community, was really pretty well received. So I think that the president is pushing forward again. And this is in the realm of what the president can do on his own without congressional approval, because there are other aspects of the Cuba opening that will require Congress to approve. He's pushing for what he can do unilaterally.
I mean, Rachel, there's still some, at least on paper, restrictions, part of an educational group or a journalist or this or that. But the word I appear to be getting out of Washington is that basically it's wide open. Are we going to see Americans all over the streets of Havana? Is it going to be Copacabana 1958 again?
There's going to be a tremendous opening. We certainly seem to be heading in that direction. There are some limitations remaining. You can't bring back maybe all the Cuban cigars that you might want to, right, but you'll have to parcel those out. But certainly a tremendous opening, and really a dramatic, a seismic one that we've seen over the past couple of weeks.
I can't get to all our callers. We got Josh in Buffalo saying, hey, to our caller from the Carolinas, hey, Josh says, we do want a businessman at the helm, and that's American values too in this country. Jack, I got to ask just for a second about Boko Haram. Big attacks there in Nigeria and on the border last week. Satellite images of villages there just wiped out. People saying, why all the uproar over Charlie Hebdo, where we have thousands of structures knocked down, all kinds of death under these Boko Haram attacks? Well, there they are. The images are pretty bad, Jack.
They are. Satellite photographs taken by Human Rights Watch just show perhaps as many as 3,000 buildings damaged or destroyed. Estimates run as high as 2,000 people killed, although there's some step back from that. Meanwhile, the Nigerian government, which was quick to denounce the attacks in Paris, had a muted response to all this. You know, the incompetence of that government, the incompetence of the military. By the way, this same same area or town or city, whatever it is, I guess it's a small city, was attacked in 2011 by the army because they thought the people there were too sympathetic to Boko Haram, and the army killed a bunch of people, and the army burnt down a couple of thousand buildings. I mean, it's just a terrible situation there, and we now have hands off. We are not training them anymore, and our State Department basically made a statement, these people, the army, they're not in the business of fighting.
It seems like too much to get into, Michael. On the other hand, you have big patches of the world in such disarray. It's not a healthy situation.
No, it's not. But, you know, a far larger portion of humanity is still living in relative peace. We should remember that.
Yes. Let us hang on to that right here, right now. Michael Hirsch with Politico Magazine, national editor there. Thank you so much for being with us this week, Michael.
Thanks for having me again.
Rachel Smolkin, executive editor at CNN Politics. Rachel, you're terrific. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
And Jack, it's always great to have you, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.